Recording is on.
Okay. Well, quickly, as you know, we have a special guest today. Neil John is going to be talking with us about some of the tech standards that they all use to make decisions. And I'm going to let Mike introduce him in a little bit. But first of all, let me just remind everyone of our code of ethics and professional conduct. You can find the link to that in the agenda if you want to read it more thoroughly. But we definitely want to make sure that this is a collaborative community, which it is, and one of the things I love most about it. The IP note, anybody can participate in these calls. However, anyone who wants to contribute substantial work needs to be a member of the CCG with full IPR agreements. The links to those are also in the agenda. I will tell you, I get an automatic a notification every time someone joins the CCG, and it has been really interesting for me the last couple of months. How many people are joining this community is really actively growing, and I actually see some folks who have recently joined here with us today on the call. And one of the things we've started doing is sending out some good introductory materials. So if you want to weigh in on those, or I'm going to put the link in the chat once I stop talking so that you can review those as well. We do keep a minute and audio recording of everything that's said on these calls. We definitely invite your participation, and if you want to contribute into the conversation, please put Q+ in the chat, Q- if you change your mind, and we definitely will be keeping this in the audio file, so not held on IRC. If you have comments in the chat that are offline, you know, those may be deleted. We are not going to hopefully need a scribe today, and we'll cross that bridge if we get to it. And so now we are at introductions and reintroductions. Do I have anybody who wants to introduce themselves? Okay. Next is announcements and reminders. Does anyone have any announcements and reminders? Anu.
Yeah, thanks, Kimberly. There was a call. Sorry. DIDCore has been approved for promotion to a global standard. So hooray, that's great. There was a call for DID press release testimonials. I'm going to put the link in here. Call for DID press release testimonials. You do not have to be a W3C member to submit a testimonial. So basically, there's going to be a press release that goes out announcing DIDs to the world as a global web standard by W3C. At the bottom of that press release, the one that W3C kind of keeps for all time, there can be any number of testimonials from W3C members or non-W3C members that like DIDs. So if you have an organization that is using DIDs or plans to use DIDs in the future, please consider submitting a testimonial by the end of this week. There's a hard deadline by July 15th. We have to have all those testimonials in and approved. And that's it.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else with an announcement or reminder?
Yeah, I've got one more quick one here. If you are an AC at W3C proper or are in touch with your AC, please do make sure folks are attending the actual AC calls today. There are AC meetings today, and there's a lot of interesting topics rolling around, especially related to governance and board construction and timing that genuinely every AC needs to be paying attention to as far as, you know, future of W3C and direction and financial stability, et cetera. So please do engage. That is our voice, right? And that's why we are members of W3C. If you're just a community group member, this doesn't apply to you, but did need to make sure to bring that up. So
Mike, would you explain what an AC is?
Yeah, basically think the member representative for, W3C. So, you know, and I know, Kimberly, for instance, I think it's your CTO or CIO is the AC because I see him on lists from time to time, et cetera. So.
Great. Thank you. Anybody else? All right. I am going to go ahead and turn it over to you, Mike, to introduce Anil.
Sure. So I'll make this brief because I want to make sure Anil has plenty of time to talk, but I've had the pleasure of engaging with Anil in this community and, you know, kind of broadly in the, conversations around decentralized identifiers and security and how do we make good verifiable claims about data and all sorts of different use cases. And one thing that I genuinely like about Anil is the fact that he's deeply committed to doing the right thing. And that's impressive from two aspects. One, in tech, it's always easy to get pulled away down solving fun problems versus necessarily things that can scale and actually be practical and then solve real world problems around privacy. And that stuff is very top of mind, I know, to him, and it's always a pleasure to have him in to speak. So with that, Anil, I'm going to pass it over to you and your wonderfully high-res screen share here.
All right. Just wanted to make sure that you are getting the full experience, Mike, both on the video and the audio.
Absolutely. Everything is coming through well.
All right. That obviously means that we have completely jinxed everything, so we'll just go with that. So, you know, thank you very much to the, you know, TriJS and the W3C CCG Core for inviting me to just give an update on our program agenda, quick agenda for what I'll go through. I've already sent these slides to the listserv and happy to answer, you know, questions at the end, simply because I presented enough to the CCG to know that if I take one of your incredibly interesting questions in the middle, we will immediately go down, you know, multiple avenues and tangents, and we will not get to, everything that we need to go to. So I'm happy to take the questions, but let me make sure that I take it at the end. So I know, as Kimberly noted, there's a lot of people who have joined the CCG. And for those of you who do not know where I'm from and what we do, I'm with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I'm with our Science and Technology Directorate, which is the part of the department that works with all of our operational and business units. Think, FEMA, think U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, think Customs and Border Protection. We are the science advisor, as well as the R&D arm of the department. And in particular, I live within a program called the Silicon Valley Innovation Program that is designed to bring innovative technology from across the globe, from small to, you know, small organizations that are truly innovative, typically do not work with government, and bring those technologies into use by the department itself, right? So regarding, you know, DITs and VCs, which is what we're here to talk about, we've been, since our 2018 solicitation, we've been contractually committed to work out in the open on all the work that we do. This actually is part and parcel of the solicitation that went out that required that any companies that we basically awarded are required to actively work out in the open and do it in a manner to bring in the feedback from the global community, because we believe that it was really important with these standards and technologies to actually get it done right, get it done openly, and to get global feedback. In 2018, more than 200 companies applied. We ended up working with and selecting ultimately 7 companies that are currently in the portfolio. You will recognize many of them because they are active. In fact, you should recognize all of them because all of them are active members of this particular community. What you will also note is that we are one of the few programs within the U.S. government that have the ability to, fund and work with innovative companies, not just in the U.S., but globally. And we have found that to be remarkably powerful for one particular reason. It is often very, very easy for a government organization that puts a contract into place with a, specific vendor to sort of get caught up in the echo chamber of that vendor's perspective. We are fortunate in that we have a, global cohort of companies that are bringing perspectives not just from the Americas, not just from the U.S. and Canada, but also from EU and from the Pacific side as well, right? So, and that has been really important because that diverse perspectives and diverse opinions gives us a way to ensure that we're not sort of, being biased to one perspective or one ecosystem or one technology stack or one something, right? So this has been immensely important for us. And we also, in order to reduce bias on the government side itself, we multi-track. We fund multiple companies simultaneously to solve the same problems. Again, to make sure that we're not sort of getting caught up in the, ecosystem and the echo chamber of one company's or one platform provider's or one technology provider's perspective. So, DHS and W3C, I'll keep it short. We've been with you on the journey with this community since the beginning. Not lately, not recently, not when things were going right, but from the beginning. So why are we interested in verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers? We have actually three separate work streams. One of them is led by our U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. So this is the part of DHS that is as old as America, right? So, if you are looking at the U.S. federal government and you're looking at the type of credentials that we issue, other than the passport, which is issued by our Department of State, the other truly high-value credentials, think certificates of naturalization, a U.S. permanent resident card that allows you to share information that you are eligible to live and work in the United States, a certificate of citizenship, a certificate of, as I mentioned, naturalization already, employment authorization documents. These are all credentials that are issued by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, and they have a global footprint, as you might well imagine. So they're very interested in using open standards, open technologies, as a way to digitally issue credentials that we currently already issue in a paper-based form, right? So from that perspective, our implementation pattern is something that you're all very familiar with. And this is, very much lined up with the combination of the use of VCs and DIDs, right? So, I will simply note that we make some nuances in how we articulate the role of what the VC data model called a verifiable data registry. In our parlance, we call that a metadata resolver, simply for one very simple reason, right? Say, when you are an issuer of a credentials, you publish metadata about what you issue and how you issue it. That could be a document that basically contains the endpoints, the public keys, and the like, but it could also be information about how we can check for the credential status of what we do. So we sort of, blend it into a conceptual unit called the metadata resolver that is analogous and is a representation of what the VC data model calls a verifiable data registry. And in our issuance infrastructure itself, we are also very, very much focused on the fact that we are requiring and implementing a bring your own DID to the table implementation. We are not issuing an identifier to our immigrants or our customers. We are expecting them to come to the table with a with the identifier that we can ensure that we do a proof of possession of. Then we bind that identifier to a verifiable credential. Now, as I mentioned, we have multiple work streams. The second work stream is with the other part of the American government that is as old as America, U.S. Customs. And if you're familiar with them, and even if you're not, just in general, if you are shipping goods into the U.S., you need to provide data to the U.S. Customs and such that they can basically evaluate, yes, no, we want to talk to you more about what goods are moving into the U.S. And supply chains are complex beasts. They have multiple hops that are owned by multiple entities. And, and it is really, really important for U.S. Customs in order to ensure that they have visibility into the entities and the supply chain and what they are bringing into the U.S. So this is sort of and our focus tends to be currently with the VCs and DIDs, our focus is on digitizing the documentation that are related to the import of steel, e-commerce, agriculture, oil and gas products into the U.S. That's our starting point, and then we will expand from there. You will note that the implementation pattern here is actually going to be a little bit different, because these are about organizations talking to each other. Each organization individually could be a issuer of an attestation of a credential, but it could also be a verifier of it. And because we wanted to make a distinction between a personal digital wallet that is controlled by an individual and the organizational storage mechanism or whatever, we are calling that organizational storage mechanism a digital vault. Obviously, a lot of these companies and organizations are also using the encrypted data vault standards and others as a way to store that information. But in general, this is sort of the implementation pattern that we see in our U.S. Customs and import use cases and our work stream. And it is really, really important to note that both of these things are active for us. And last but not least, our third work stream tends to be a little bit bespoke. This is actually driven by some laws and policies within the U.S. government about the minimization of the collection and use of the Social Security number. For those folks from outside the U.S., who do not know our challenges with this, a Social Security number was a number that was created in the 1930s, around the 1930s, to identify a social benefit that has over time became conflated with an authenticator. So people are currently in a lot of cases, using just the knowledge of SSN as an authenticator to identify people on the remote end of the wire, which is obviously a really bad idea and has resulted in a significant amount of challenges with identity fraud within the U.S. context itself. So our privacy office, our chief privacy officer and our privacy office is championing and looking at, is there a way to sort of use decentralized identifiers internally within the department as a mechanism for the to replace the day-to-day usage and storage of the SSN. And we have a couple of use cases there that you can read. I don't have a pretty diagram to talk about it, but this tends to be a little bit bespoke to us, and it's an interesting case for us to move forward on this, right? So those are the three work streams that we currently have, right? So, and for us, it's really, really important that as a government public entity, we sort of ensure that we anchor our implementation on a set of principles and open standards that are truly traceable, testable, and ultimately can be used not just by us, but by anybody who wants to leverage this, because obviously we are a public entity that is using taxpayer-funded money in order to do this work, and we want to make sure that the work that we're doing is usable by anybody who wants to use it with no restrictions. So let me walk you through some of the choices that we are making, first and foremost, right? And one of the basic things, whether we're talking about our personal credential work stream or our organizational credential work stream, is we are absolutely committed to implement and encourage and support multiple independent, interoperable, and standard-based implementations here. We've been, in the past, been walked into a corner by vendors with proprietary APIs, proprietary implementations that lock us into that particular platform or a standard or a technology. We're not planning on doing that this time. And we are absolutely not interested in a situation where, technology providers and vendors become gatekeepers between the relationship between government and our customers, right? So that is really important. And some of the choices that we're making in order to ensure that principle is supported, obviously, is working out in the open. In areas such as the Credential Community Group, to build vocabularies, test suites, and APIs under your umbrella, under the standards umbrella, not under the DHS umbrella, so that it is something that we can get feedback on, other people can participate and provide input into, and it is something that is usable by the broader community and not just us. Absolutely encouraging all of the work that we're doing here to be something that is, global visibility, global feedback, require interoperably plug fest, not just let me throw a profile out there and let me say that 5 organizations implemented. Yeah, that's not a path to success for it. And I'll talk about how we're doing it in, concretely as well, right? And the other piece of it is, in this ecosystem, in a lot of ways, the locus of control and in a ways is moving from what used to be identity providers, then to relying parties, now to the digital wallet ecosystem. So it is really, really important for us to encourage choice in that area. We support, a lot of the thinking that the Canadian, like our colleagues from Canada are, doing in the space, as well as our colleagues from the European Commission are doing in the space regarding the importance of digital wallets and the ensuring that they are truly open and, interoperable. So, we're very much committed to ensuring that, we're not, focused on encouraging wallets that require proprietary implementations. And ultimately, I already talked about the fact that we multi-track our implementation to make sure that we ensure that multiple innovative companies are able to bring technology and implementations to the table. Given that a lot of the work that is of interest to a lot of the people here are in the personal credential and the individual digital identity piece, I wanted to highlight something from the part of the work that is focused on that from our U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services that are truly principles that they are focused on, right? So for us and for them, for individual credentials, it is a choice of whether you want a digital credential or not. You are able to do all of the businesses that you need to do with our physical credentials. We continue to support them. We will continue to support them for a variety of very good reasons. Digital inclusion, ensuring that people who either choose to or cannot have access to digital credentials also have the same access to the services is really important. So for us, digital credentials are a choice that have to be requested by a person before we issue something to them, and the paper-based credentials will continue to exist. We are absolutely focused on ensuring and eliminating any type of phone home architecture and technology implementations. And you can see the choices that we're making there in order to make sure that we are doing so in our implementation. We also want to make sure that back-channel interactions between verifiers of the credentials and issuers, which are not visible to the holder or our customers, are absolutely not something that we support. As you all know, the verifiable credentials data model standards actually does support the ability for a For example, for a verify to, you know, ask for a credential to be refreshed by, from a issuer. We saw that and we thought that that was, while it is supported by the standard, it is not supported, it is not something that we will support on the personal credential side, as a, implementation choice, because we believe that that takes away visibility of that request and establishes a back channel, interaction, outside of the knowledge of the holder of the credential itself. So that's not something that we will support. We are absolutely committed to selective disclosure capabilities that do not have any lock into any platform or technology. And we are currently, you know, very much, supporting DBS plus signatures as the way forward on that one as well. And as I mentioned, you know, we've been consistent from the beginning that just because you are using standards does not mean that you are interoperable. So we require in all of the work that we do that we verify standards compliance using conformance test suites that are developed within this community. And this is definitely something that our companies that we are funding are obviously contributing to, such that it is usable and, you know, broadly available to everybody. But we go, as you well know, and given all the politics around it, this should be, embedded within all of our psyche at this point, right? At point in time. Standards are created by people. People make compromises. People make choices in order to get a standard out the door, which often means that there are multiple ways of implementing the same thing that is often in the standard. And two vendors could implement, the standard and be fully standards compliant, but completely not interoperable because they've made different choices. So for us, interoperability, that is standards based, is really important. So we require, contractually require, that we have multi-party interoperability plug fest that ensure that multiple platforms, multiple implementations, multiple technology stacks have the ability to truly interoperate in a mix and match manner. Let me be very clear. I do not consider everybody choosing the same platform with different use cases to be a demonstration of interoperability. It's not. That is software monoculture. And we've gone down that path before to not good places. So a true multi-vendor interoperability that is demonstrated and testable is really important for us. And for those who know me from before my DHS time, you know that in a previous life, I used to be the technical lead for the U.S. federal government's Identity Credential and Access Management Program. This is the program that ran the Trust Framework Solutions Program that certified and accredited private sector identity services that could be bought by the government. And I learned some significant amount of lessons from that experience, right? One of them is, you know, I have had the pen and I have owned the, you know, the profiles of, you know, SAML and attribute exchange for the federal government. And, you know, this is typically where a whole bunch of really smart people get together and define a profile, then try to get people to implement that profile. We were successful to some degree, but it is a very heavy lift. So when we started this work on the DHS side, we flipped the script and said, what we will start from is truly demonstrated interoperability first and foremost. So we will use the interoperability plug fest and the choices that are being made within there as a way to document what needs to go into the profile, rather than starting from the profile and trying to work our way down and trying to get people implemented. We wanted to start from code that was working, that was truly interoperable across multiple implementation, and document that into a profile that bakes in the security, privacy, and interoperability expectations that are needed by all of us in our implementation. So that profile piece really becomes really, really important, and it is built from the ground up rather than top down. And so So I think that might be a, you know, good segue into, you know, giving you an outline of what are the things that we are truly profiling and how are we thinking about the profiles that we are envisioning and how we expect that to operate, right? Because I've seen enough profiles to know these days about the amount of hand waving that sort of goes into. And I also know there are, you know, things that are completely moving on a regular basis right now. So I'm very concerned about the fact that there are things that people are talking about and there are things that there are people are not talking about. So in our profile, and when we talk about profile, these are some of the things that we are talking about, profiling. The identifiers that, that are used to identify entities, whether they are people, whether they are organizations. And for us, at a very granular level, we will, for each of these things, we intend to provide informative information that is, tutorial guidance on why we chosen to do what we chosen to do. Very normative text about what it requires in order to be compliant to the profile. And truly important automated conformance tests that you can use in order to ensure that you are indeed, walking the talk here. It is not enough to basically put a profile out there and say, hey, 5 different companies implemented it. That is really not that helpful, because there is a whole bunch of trust us, we know what we're doing that goes on into those type of work, right? We actually wanted to be in the position that the profile should be testable and there should be conformance tests that people can run on a regular basis in order to verify the conformance against the things that we profile. So, profiling identifiers, metadata about what an identifier is sharing. These are things like, what goes on in a, dig JSON file. How do we profile, status list 2021, for, credential verification and revocation checking? How do we resolve it? What are the things that a resolver needs to take care of? What are the things that it needs to check? What are the questions that it can answer for us? And what are the questions that it cannot answer for us? And it's also really, really important, and one of the reasons I sort of articulated our multiple work streams is to very clearly note that in some cases we have diverse and in some almost competing priorities within what the different parts of DHS wants to do. For example, in the personal credential issuance piece by USCIS and PRIV, unlinkability and privacy and choice of the identifiers used, how things are structured, is really, really, really important. Providing selective disclosure, providing, ensuring nobody can basically track you across space and time in how these credentials are used when you are an individual with these type of credentials. That is a really important principle, and the choices that we're making there are driving us towards that. So we will have how we are implementing unlinkability and the profiling of the choices that we're making very clearly articulated there. Unlinkability is not a desired outcome for our supply chain use cases. I will simply note that supply chain use cases for U.S. Customs requires visibility into the actors in the supply chain, requires understanding of if those entities are using, forced labor practices or child labor, which are not allowed by U.S. law, whether they are sanctioned entities that are trying to pretend to be, somebody that they're not in the supply chain. So the ability to use technology and standards to hide yourself from providing that information is not a desired outcome for our organizational credential use cases that come into play in the supply chain. So we are going to be talking about how the traceability aspects of the supply chain pieces are also going to be implemented in the profile as well. And again, what is real right now is also, with all of the discussions that we are talking about around quantum resistant cryptography and the cryptographic choices, fundamentally a lot of the choices within our standards are obviously enabled by the use of cryptography. The US government has very hard requirements on the type of cryptography that can be used in systems that connect to and are used by them. So for us, FIPS-compliant cryptography is first and foremost a hard requirement in the choices that we're making. But we're also looking at, is there an opportunity to profile that, for example, a JSON-LD based verifiable credential with a linked data proof can actually have multiple different types of proofs attached to it. One proof could be using a cryptographic primitive that is fully FIPS compliant. The second one could be something that is more experimental using quantum resistant cryptography. For example, I think the three big choices NIST announced recently, Dilithium, Falcon, and Sphinx Plus are in play right now. So can you have one of those that is appropriate in addition to the FIPS compliant cryptography? Then obviously the BBS Plus signature is moving through the IETF and CFRG going forward. In talking to NIST, they are actively tracking that work as well. So is there a way to sort of provide that as an option as well? So we're trying to figure out how best we make choices that give us cryptographic flexibility now and going forward without impacting the user experience. And those are things that we're going to be profiling within there as well. And obviously within the credential itself, what are the data models that we support? I will be very clear on noting that a required shell here will be JSON LD with linked data proofs, right? Now the question becomes, are there others that could be and a lot of it will come down to the cryptographic flexibility and things like that that are possible, and we are working through that right now. Again, profiling how we deliver a credential to a digital wallet in the personal credential use case, how we deliver it to a digital wallet in an organization to organization use case. Credential verification, revocation, refresh, aggregation, selective disclosure. These are all ingredients that go into a recipe, right? So we consider this to be you need to basically profile at the ingredient level, and each of them will have informative, normative, and conformance tests associated with that. And again, this is where I keep saying that basically there's a lot of things that need to be considered in order to get to a full implementation. Some of the feedback that we got when we engaged with the advocacy community and the privacy and civil liberty community, about a couple of months ago, we got some really good feedback from them about information and implementation things that we need to consider from a technical perspective. It's not just about consent to share data with the verifier. It is also, is there a way to notify credential holders about the verifier's intended use of that shared data so that they can, such that a person can make an informed decision about what to share and what not to share? I talked about the fact that basically digital wallets are becoming more of a locus of control in this ecosystem, as can be seen by all of the work that is going on both in our ecosystem as well as in the European Union, as well as in our Canadian colleagues' ecosystems as well, right? Not to mention, much more globally as well. So how do we, come up with a mechanism that provides a, wallet selector mechanism that is truly interoperable? I also consider that a lot of these things also have mechanism that allows us to, signal intent. I am an issuer that basically signal into a digital wallet that basically tells them these are my capabilities that I have. What can you support? And this is I'm a digital wallet that is signaling to a verifier, hey, these are the things that I can support. You know, how do I do that? And how I'm a verifier that is signaling to a digital wallet that shows up at my front door saying that these are the things that I support, it sort of comes under a limited umbrella of query language, but I think it is broader than that. And we're looking at what are the ways that we sort of need to signal intent in each of these places and also have the ability to technically implement that. And I'm a big believer in feature detection rather than product detection. I think when it comes to digital wallet and digital wallet features, I think it is very easy when you go down the product detection thing in order to get yourself siloed into the implementations that are out there. But if you're truly about ensuring choice in that new locus of control, which is the wallet, you need to basically have the ability to sort of detect the features that are supported by the wallet so that you can basically interact with it in a truly open manner. And there are different ways of doing that. You could do it in a brute force manner using independent testing of the wallets itself. But is there a way to sort of do some sort of a cryptographic challenge or response? In the long term, I fully think that there has to be some manner of a certification, accreditation by, you know, truly competent third parties around the features that are in a wallet that we consume as cross marks of that allow us to know that, yea, verily, these wallets have these features because these have been verified by an entity and they've given them that trust mark. So as such, they are good for us to use within our ecosystem. So the intent about, with all of these, what I call ingredients is to, basically have a combination of recipes. So our intent here with the profile is you should be using each of the things that I just talked about as ingredients that go into building a recipe for a personal credential issuance workflow, a organizational credential issuance workflow. And the important thing, they all are not going to be identical. They are all actually going to be very different. The way that our supply chain issuance flow works is very much going to be different from a personal credential, issuance flow. And that is perfectly fine. So one of the things is that's why the granularity of these ingredients becomes really important, because then what we are able to do is obviously mix and match them in these workflows and journeys in order to enable capabilities using the vocabularies that are out there, right? So this is the way that we are looking at this profile. This is a profile that is a work in progress. Will we have all of this defined out of the gate? Absolutely not. Are these things that we need to keep in mind so that the choices that we make today do not close off other choices that are articulated here? Absolutely. So, I know that for some of you who are new to the CCG, you can find, where to find the link to the standards, but a lot of the things that we've contributed to that are available to all of you, the citizenship vocabulary, which is something that we are using in our immigration credential piece, the supply chain traceability vocabulary that is being used within our supply chain use case, the traceability interoperability work that is being done by the supply chain piece. As I mentioned, one of the things that we are very much into is demonstrating how interoperability will work then using that to document what goes in the profile. So you can see that ongoing work going on our supply chain side in the, you know, traceability, interoperability work link that is there. And you can see that traceability open API that is a profile of the, you know, VC API that is actually using that concretely, right? So again, walking the talk here publicly with full feedback and, input from all of you in the global community. We've done, cryptography analysis of both the VC and the DIT standards, that is allowing us to, drive our implementation and our choices. BBS plus signatures are the mechanism that we envision for selective disclosure going forward. Wanted to point to the fine work that is being done by, Transmute, Measure.io, Google, IBM, and I believe one more company whose name is
Amazon.
Thank you. In the IETF around, JSON encoding for, post-quantum signatures, which becomes a building block for how to incorporate that within the linked data, proof ecosystem going forward as well. Again, and I think, you're aware of from the emails in the listserv about the Warlock Selector Playground, that is using Chappie as well. So, that's sort of, my pitch, and an update here. I am happy to sort of, let me kill the sharing here if you don't mind, so that you're not seeing this, hopefully that stopped the sharing, Mike.
I did indeed. And, I know I had seen, Phil on queue earlier. Phil, did you have a question or was that just in regards to, getting a copy of the deck? Cause that I had just lag.
That was just getting, oh shoot. Hello.
Hello.
Yep, you're good.
Okay, good. That was just in copy, for getting a copy of the deck, which I have now. Thank you.
No worries.
Awesome.
I'm happy to answer any questions. Wanted to make sure I sort of articulate at least where we are going. And obviously, happy to answer questions, point you to the test suites and things like that, that are on there. And Adrian would love to speak, and I would love to hear from you, Adrian.
I really appreciated, towards the end when you mentioned that you reached out to the privacy and advocacy community for their input. And that slide labeled 3 of 4 that listed the basically the requirements that are coming up. At least that's the way I treat them.
It is. I can send you up. There were 3 things that actually we got back as feedback. I'll simply note, Adrian, that our chief privacy officer, Lynn Parker Debris, is pretty damn awesome, and she basically reached out on our behalf to the civil liberty and privacy advocacy community, and it was a pretty intense 4 to 5 hour pretty much an entire day session with them to articulate them and the choices that we're making, getting their feedback, and taking their feedback and trying to figure out how to bake it into the engineering on the things that we're not thought of.
Right. So I just have one question of you. Like I say, that was a great slide, and I'm glad to see you're doing this. What I don't understand yet in your roadmap is where delegation comes into the protocol picture that obviously threads through both where we are now and where we're going. I did not see that mentioned, and I'm curious because it also impacts the interaction between CCG and IETF, for example, that I've been, focusing on in the last couple of months. So is delegation?
No, this is Anil dropping the ball on you, Adrian. Delegation should have been one of the things that we profile. In there. So I will make sure that is corrected and added as part of what the end game for us is. But having said that, I think I've responded on this back to you, but I will reiterate my private responses on this as well, right? So, for us, you know, one of the things that is really important for us is to ensure that we are bootstrapping off of our existing physical credentials, and there is existing processes around delegation of authority in how a immigration credential is used that currently exists and is used by that ecosystem. So there is an option for that within the physical credential ecosystem. So which is why it is something that we want to have as a capability in the digital side eventually, but it is also not something that we're going to tackle first and foremost out of the gate.
Thank you.
No worries. No, thank you for, I knew you were, as soon as you got on the call, you know that I knew that you were, I was thinking to myself, oh God, I forgot that. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for noting all that, Anil, because it is an important topic. Allison, I see you on the queue.
Yeah. Thank you. And thanks for that amazing presentation. I really learned a lot. I am coming to SSI from the blockchain industry, so I'm curious to know what solutions are you using or contemplating using to anchor the SSI data?
So as the person who 7 years ago, basically, when the bottle spun around the table around the applicability of blockchain technologies to DHS, the person who ended up holding the bag was me. I own the R&D program around blockchain and DLT technologies. There is a separate set of, you know, Genesis documents, for lack of a better word. Yes, I am overloading that. That comes into how we ended up putting our support behind DIDs and VCs, that are coming from the blockchain arena. The long and the short of it is we learned very quickly that 90 to 95% of the use cases that are being articulated for blockchain technologies does not require any type of blockchain at all. So at the same time, we also realized that our counterparties in the trade community, in the other communities, were also very enthusiastic about blockchain technologies. So we needed a mechanism that allowed our enterprise systems to work with both blockchain technologies and non-blockchain technologies and across blockchain technologies. And the choice that we made was to ensure that if you are bringing a blockchain to DHS, you need to ensure that there is a interoperability layer that is built on top of that blockchain that consists of verifiable credentials as the data model, decentralized identifiers as the identifier mechanism, and a set of standard APIs. So my job over the last 3 or 4 years within DHS has been to make blockchain go away by ensuring that we have a layer of interoperability around it, which is why we are using these standards, which are applicable and have no dependency on blockchain, but also can be used with the blockchain as well. But to come back to your question originally, that was a long-winded answer. Sorry about that. Coming back to your question, we are not anchoring anything within a blockchain at this point. Now, for example, that way that we identify ourselves as an entity, USCIS and CBP will identify ourselves as issuers and verifiers in the ecosystem, is using DIDWeb as a mechanism. The .gov top-level domain is owned and operated by the U.S. government. We have a significant amount of confidence in that domain infrastructure. We have a significant amount of confidence in our web infrastructure, so it makes sense for us to use that. We are not on the personal credential side actually issuing any decentralized identifiers to an immigrant. For a variety of reasons, the simplest and most expedient being, we do not want to have any question whatsoever that we are issuing some manner of an identifier that we are then using to, you know, track people's usage across space and time. And the easiest way to not sort of go down that idiotic rabbit hole is to simply ensure that we don't issue a DID to that person, right? So we're not anchoring them in that type of thing. On the trade side, obviously, you know, there might be entities within the broader trade community who might be bringing decentralized identifiers that are anchored in DLTs or blockchains. So that is perfectly fine for us. It is not something that we are issuing or, implementing. It is something that we need to verify. We just need to ensure that the security, privacy, and interoperability properties of that implementation are something that we find acceptable or not. Does that help, Allison?
Yes, very much. Thank you. It's very interesting.
Awesome. And I'm looking at time here. We've got about 3.5 minutes or so left. Are there any final questions in or any kind of closing thoughts? If not, I'd love to put Tim Boma on the spot just for his feedback and thoughts since I see him on the line, unless he dropped off, which he may have.
If he hasn't, I'm going to basically, Tim, as you know, if Tim is on the line, by all means, would love to hear from him. He's moved on to a new role within the Canadian government, into the, you know, standards and verification side. Would love to know what he's doing. But I'd also, Perk, I hate to put you on the spot here, but the person who's actually currently within the U.S., Canadian government who is, who's taken over the identity file in the Treasury Board Secretary is actually Perth Singh. I noticed that he is present. Hoping that he will, would love to, I'm sorry, my friend, to put you on the spot. I hope that you, can pretend that you are completely dropped off, by the way, if you don't want to answer anything.
I know. Thanks. I'm right here. I'm listening and, great presentation. Lots of other questions. We're very, very interested in actually some of the conformance, sort of the criteria that is coming out of the work that you guys are doing. I think that will help us a lot to sort of, leverage that approach and maybe build on it. I think it would be very, very interesting.
Thank you, sir. Mike, back to you. Tim, are you still on by any chance, or have you left for finer pastures?
Am I still on, or did Tim leave? I believe Tim left.
Okay,
so,
never mind.
Yeah. I would just kind of, I guess, open it up for any kind of final closing thoughts. This is a great session. It's very helpful, to just kind of look at this stuff. I appreciate the openness around this initiative because I think it's important, right? For the, reasons that Adrian's noted, et cetera. This is stuff that definitely concerns us and concerns us globally, right? And this approach is unique in government and is something that I am a huge fan of. So, any closing thoughts, as we wrap up here?
The only closing thought is basically even though there are many competitors in the space and in the vendor community here, there is a foundation that is useful and important for all of us to work together on. But we want to make sure that the foundation is actually truly interoperable and that interoperability is actually testable, right? I would encourage anybody, globally to take a look at the work that is being done in the CCG, in the test suites that are being, developed and implemented, and to provide feedback, open pull requests against it, contribute to it and integrate with them on a regular basis so that we are all sort of moving in the general direction. It is going to be real that different jurisdictions will have different priorities in what they're doing, but I also think that there is an opportunity for us to have a set of, common foundational ingredients that we can all share that we put together in different recipes that are applicable to us. So let's work on those ingredients together. And let's make sure that they are testable, truly interoperable, and so that we can mix and match them into what makes sense for all of you within your different verticals, different use cases, and different jurisdictions.
No, that's awesome. And, yeah, obviously I think we've gotten to the point where a lot of these test suites are now, moving forward in a pretty good way. And You know, so would it be fair to say, you know, if you've got implementations or you're working with them, generally speaking, please register with those test suites and start showing that interoperability? Or what's your final comment there? Or did I lose an L now?
No, you did not lose an L. I see that Adrian has his hand up, by the way, just in case.
Yeah. Okay.
Just a quick question, if you can. How should we or you react to the initiatives on the mobile driver's license ISO standards and on the passkey wallet announcements as they relate to the work that we're promoting here?
Can I use the time has run out in order to run away from that question?
You may, because I think that's going to merit us. Actually, it's an important question.
I'm happy to answer, but it's also a nuanced answer. So I don't want to be in a position where a half-assed answer is weaponized by people for other things.
Yeah. Yeah, and Adrian, that's an important enough topic. We'll make sure that that gets a full dedicated meeting, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Well, thanks all. I'm going to stop recording. Really appreciate everyone's time today. And, yeah, or well, I guess Kimberly will stop recording because she's in charge of that since
Got
she started
it.
It.
Yeah.
And, cool. Once again, thanks so much, everyone. Really, really enjoyed the questions.